For the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training. This is part three of our three-part series on LNAPLs, using LNAPL science and the LCSM and LNAPL goals to select an LNAPL remedial technologies. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to very quickly cover introductory material in the first few slides and then turn the training over to our trainers from the ITRC LNAPL team. Today's training is based on the ITRC guidance document. We do encourage you to use the document after the training class. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network. A few housekeeping items to go over. We are recording today's session. The trainers control the slides. If you'd like to, you're welcome to download the presentation, and that's back on that Clue-In training page we started today. I encourage you to send in questions throughout today's class using the Q&A box in the lower right. We will get to some of these questions during the question and answer breaks. For other questions, we are going to ask our trainers to respond, and a reminder for trainers, respond privately to those questions that are asked. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information. If you need to access the feedback form before we wrap up today, in the related links, the last item is feedback, so you may need to scroll down, and that's the middle right, related links. And to get those links to work, you need to select the link and then select Browse to allow that link to open in a new window. The feedback form is your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class, so be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to certify you attended before you submit. Once you submit, the system will generate a certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. And please visit the ITRC website to learn more about what is available. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. Our first trainer today will be Tom Fox at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Next, we'll hear from Tom Pelaya with CH2M Hill, now Jacobs. We also have Lloyd Dunlap at TriHydro and Joanne Dyson at West Central Environmental Consultants. I'll now turn today's training over to Tom Fox at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Tom?
Thanks, Juliana. Well, I'd like to welcome you to part three of our ITRC LNAPL training series. We're going to assume everyone attended parts one and two and that you've taken the time to get familiar with the guidance document online. And basically, the guidance document, not to reiterate too often, has some expanded sections. We've expanded the LNAPL key concepts or the science behind what we're going to talk about today. We've also developed and fleshed out the conceptual site model for LNAPL. We've identified a lot of SMART goals, and we'll mention those again later. And we've also expanded LNAPL transmissivity and natural source zone depletion sections with appendices. So for about the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to walk you through some introductory stuff, and then we'll be moving on. The main takeaway from parts one and two is that you need to use LNAPL science and apply it smartly to make good decisions at your site. And also that you have to develop a clear LCSM to identify your LNAPL concerns and establish appropriate remedial goals and objectives. So one thing I wanted to bring up, one key point, is it's really important to use your LCSM to help you select remedial technology and achieve your goals. And you'll see as we go through the process today that we repeatedly come back to the LCSM to refine it and make it clearer and more accurate for our purposes. Here are our learning objectives for the three-part series. Part one, as I mentioned, we talked about LNAPL science. In part two, we worked on developing our LNAPL conceptual site model development process and how we can inform stakeholders about the decision-making process. We're also going to be, on part three today, we're going to be selecting remedial technologies to achieve these objectives. Also prepare for transitions between LNAPL strategies or technologies as the site moves through investigation and cleanup. We'll be looking at such things as treatment trains and combined remedies. And we'll also be looking at how to smartly measure progress using identified technology-specific endpoints. Finally, at the end of today, we're going to be spending about a half an hour, maybe 40 minutes, on a case study where we help to illustrate this whole process for you. Our three-part training series focuses on helping you connect the science to LNAPL site management. Part two was building your LNAPL conceptual site model, as I mentioned. And today we're going to be working on selecting and implementing LNAPL remedies. This is basically covered in Section 6 of the guidance document. And after this training, we expect that you will have the skills and knowledge to use ITRC resources to improve your decision-making at your site. Sorry, I jumped ahead there. So this is Figure 1-1 that many of you may already have up on another screen if you've got two screens at your computer that Juliana referenced at the beginning. So in relation to the process flow diagram, what we're going to be covering in Section 1 was the LNAPL science. And in Section 2 was this blue outlined area where we covered the LCSM and its development. This is the section we're going to be covering today, and that's evident on the link from the slide that Juliana posted earlier. At this point, I wanted to introduce technology grouping. One way to handle the multitude of remediation technologies that we have available is to group them as to what their purpose is and what they actually do. So today we're going to learn to understand what these, why we have these technology groups, what the groups are, and how site goals and objectives can influence the selection of a technology group. So before we get started, though, Juliana, you want to pull that initial poll up again, and let's take a look at this. So for many of you, the question was, how many different LNAPL technologies have you applied or used at your sites? And we're talking about technologies, not how many sites you've done. And most of you have only used maybe a half a dozen or less different technologies of the 21 that are available. So we're going to close that poll, Juliana. This is a list of the 21 technologies, and Lloyd Dunlap will be talking more about these later. The LNAPL guidance document includes all 21 technologies, and they're all outlined in detail in Appendix A. These technologies vary from pretty simple ones, such as excavation, to more complex technologies, such as electrical heating or in-situ smoldering. So how do you know which technology is appropriate for your site? I'd like to mention right up front that manual baling, the use of absorbent socks, passive skimmers, and periodic or short-term vacuum truck events are not included in the technology tables. The LNAPL team found that these methods generally are not very effective when recovering a significant amount of LNAPL, but depending on local regulations, aesthetic concerns, or even emergency response actions, which aren't in this document, they may very well end up being used at a site. So to look at Appendix A in a little bit more detail, the A series table screens technologies based on mainly geologic factors, but also some general technology information. The B series table for each technology then gives specific impacts of 9 other factors that each technology should be considered for. And the C series table determines minimum data requirements for each technology. These A, B, and C tables are presented in consecutive pages in Appendix A to make everything easy to find, and we also have some key literature references. One thing I wanted to point out is that Appendix A represents some typical technology that the LNAPL team is familiar with, and what we have written in there doesn't mean that you can't apply the technology in a different setting than what we've presented. This slide shows a relationship between different remediation goals and objectives. The saturation goal would be achieved by recovering or controlling LNAPL. An example of recovery would be skimming. A common example to control migrating LNAPL is a slurry wall. Compositional goals are achieved primarily through phase change technologies, such as air sparge SVE. And aesthetic goals can include both saturation and compositional goals. An example might be odor control or treating soil to remove discoloration. This figure was discussed in detail in part two, but I want to remind everyone that by following the LNAPL management process, your objectives become SMART. And the acronym SMART is shown in the lower right-hand corner for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. As we progress through part three, you'll see how we continually circle back to update the LCSM and also define objectives through the establishment of metrics and remedial endpoints. These SMART objectives are important, especially when you select the technology as your, a specific technology as your remedy. And if you can't measure progress as you're moving along, then how do you know when you're doing any good or when to quit and change? So this slide kind of introduces the remedial technology groups, and you'll note the ternary diagram here. This is also referred to as the primary mechanism in Section 5. I'd like you to notice how the dots on the ternary diagram move from one technology to another. In addition to the primary mechanism, most technologies can also act in other ways. These multiple actions of a technology can be represented in the ternary diagram by changes in the shape and location of the dot. This is Figure 5.3 from the guidance document. It's helpful to show the relationships of LNAPL state, LNAPL concern, the technology group that might be employed, and the recoverability of LNAPL itself. You can see mass control and mass recovery are only useful when LNAPL saturation is greater than residual. Mass control is used when there is a sufficient LNAPL migration risk. In other words, there's a very high saturation of LNAPL in the aquifer. Mass recovery is used when LNAPL is mobile and practically recoverable. Recoverability is represented by LNAPL transmissivity. And as you can see, mass recovery is pretty much ineffective below about 0.1 square foot per day. When LNAPL is residual, the only phase change technologies will work, but phase change technologies can also be applied to mobile and even migrating LNAPL. When you're selecting technologies, consider using multiple technologies either at the same time in different parts of the plume if it's fairly large, or plan a treatment train as remediation progresses over time. You can also combine different technologies to work together. For example, you may begin with a slurry wall to control the migration of LNAPL and then move to dual pump liquid extraction as a means to recover mobile LNAPL. Air sparging and soil vapor extraction may then be used to further remove LNAPL mass and address vapor and groundwater risks. And the final treatment technology may be natural source zone depletion. So I alluded to treatment trains here, and I wanted to point out that treatment trains are good when they're planned with SMART objectives, metrics to transition from one to another, and endpoints so you know when to stop doing what you're doing. And it also should show an orderly implementation of technologies as you progress toward closure. Typically, a lot of sites are unplanned, they lack specific SMART objectives or metrics for transition and endpoints, and the hallmark for this is where the consultant is simply throwing the next technology du jour at the problem. LNAPL aesthetic concerns, basically such as odors, stains, or sheens, could be a concern that has to be taken into account at your site. And I'd like you to ask yourself a few questions. So are odors or surficial stains from the LNAPL a potential nuisance? Or is stakeholder perception of the occurrence of LNAPL a concern? If so, have a discussion with all stakeholders to make sure that the concerns can be addressed through either saturation or compositional technologies. So let's start on the first technology grouping, LNAPL mass control. Let's dive a little bit deeper. When you have excess saturation as a remedial goal and you're concerned about migration, LNAPL mass control technologies may be used. These technologies function by essentially stopping migration of the LNAPL like a dam across a river holds back water. Note the ternary diagram in the lower right-hand corner where the dot is in the MC or mass control corner. This slide links LNAPL concerns, goals, and objectives for a saturation goal. The LNAPL concern here is migration, which is linked to a saturation-based goal to stop the LNAPL migration. We then link that goal to a remediation objective, which is to stop LNAPL with a mass control technology like a barrier. Talking about barriers, in the top panel you can see LNAPL is migrating away from the point of the release and moving to the right and away from the highest LNAPL saturation. It's trying to reach equilibrium. In the bottom panel, you can see that migration can be controlled by putting a barrier across the path of LNAPL. This is a mass control technique. LNAPL isn't removed, it's just controlled in place or directed away from a point of exposure. An example of this type of mass control technology is a slurry wall. The second group we're going to talk about is mass recovery. Conceptual example of mass recovery is vacuuming up a spill. In this example, water is being removed from around a leaky water heater. This is actually a good analogy for mass recovery. Would the shop vac get all the water up? No, but it'll remove enough to keep it from spreading further. The shop vac would recover less of the spilled water if the floor was carpet, similar to finer grained soil, instead of the concrete shown, which could be considered more like a coarser grained soil. Recovery will also allow for faster natural drying, so the life cycle of the spill is reduced. This slide links the LNAPL concern of LNAPL in wells to a saturation-based goal of reducing LNAPL when LNAPL is above the residual range, and the remediation objective is recovering LNAPL to the maximum extent practicable. You can achieve this goal by recovering enough LNAPL to reduce the LNAPL saturation and therefore its mobility. This concern, goal, and objective would be addressed through the mass recovery technology group. The third group is phase change. It's not time for a coffee break, I'm afraid, yet. So note the dot and ternary diagram in the lower right-hand corner is at the phase change or PC corner. The LNAPL concern here might be a risk of petroleum vapor intrusion overlying an LNAPL source. Our goal is compositional based to reduce the contaminants of concern in the soil vapor and in the LNAPL source. The remediation objective is to abate the vapors. This is best done with a technology in the phase change group, such as soil vapor extraction. So let's refresh a little bit. How does phase change modify the LNAPL composition? Well, it modifies it by increasing the rates of volatilization and also dissolution from the LNAPL body. Phase changes from a liquid to a vapor phase and from a liquid to the dissolve phase. Some example technologies to achieve this are soil vapor extraction, air sparging, various types of heating, enhanced degradation, or in situ chemical oxidation. So vapor technologies increase the vapor gradient between LNAPL and native environment, increasing the rate of volatilization out of the LNAPL, and changes the LNAPL composition to a lower volatile content. These technologies may leave LNAPL in place, but they can reduce or eliminate concerns such as explosive vapors, inhalation of toxic vapors, or ingestion of dissolved compounds. These technologies can sometimes be combined. Steam injection increases LNAPL volatility, reducing the volatile fraction of the LNAPL composition, and then SVE removes those vapors. This is a figure you're probably familiar with. So why is composition change important? It's a more effective way to target contaminants of concern that are essentially a small fraction of the total LNAPL mass. So let's take benzene as an example. Benzene is just one of many hydrocarbons that make up gasoline, typically only a few percent. But in many cases, it's the only component driving risk. So using a phase change technology to reduce the benzene concentration in the gasoline from point A to point C is going to be more effective than recovering some, but not all, of the bulk gasoline from A to B. Removing LNAPL doesn't decrease the benzene concentration in vapor or water. All it may do is shorten the cleanup time frame. so it's best to address the contaminant of concern directly. Juliana, we've got another poll question. So what are the three technology groups? I'll let you decide. A, unconfined, perched, or confined. B, mass control, mass recovery, and phase change. C, air sparging, skimming, and excavation. Or D, aesthetics, saturation, and composition. And I'm glad 135 of you, or 140, are paying attention. That's good. So, Juliana, would you close that out? To kind of wrap everything up today, I'd like you to remember to select your remedial goals and decide whether they're saturation or compositional based. You have to also determine your remedial objectives. Is it vapor abatement, removing mobile LNAPL, or controlling its migration? Select a technology from the three technology groups, and the three groups are, as we just discussed, mass control, mass recovery, and phase change. And consider sequencing your technologies and use the treatment train approach to get things clean. At this point, I'd like to pass the slides on to Tom Pelaya with Jacobs, and he'll talk about natural source zone depletion. And this is a process that's analogous to monitored natural attenuation for groundwater. Both processes occur at every LNAPL site to varying degrees. Tom?
That's right. Excuse me. Thank you, Tom. And, well said. And a natural source zone depletion, or NSZD, is a phase change technology, so that's where it fits into the realm that Tom was describing, principally biodegradation. And the really important thing or interesting thing is that it's happening on all of our sites. So you'll see in a few slides here that it's a relatively significant process, and it's something that's important to consider as part of your remedial technology evaluations. So let's start off with a quick poll, Juliana. Just sort of look at the starting knowledge of the group here and see how many of us have actually looked at NSCD. So the poll question, have you measured NSCD rates and incorporated it into your LCSMs or used it for remediation decision making? So good. I mean, I think you'll find through the series of slides here that we've got a fair amount of information that gets into the theory and talks about the details, some of the basics, but then some of more advanced aspects as well. So I think we can cover the range of interest levels here, experience levels. So you can close that. Thank you, Juliana. So what we're going to talk about today is the following. Yeah, first to go through a bit of the theory of natural source zone depletion, talk about its processes, and most importantly, some of the new learnings. NSCD was covered in LNAPL 1 back in 2009, but since that time, a whole lot of information has come out in the published literature. So really want to stress that and see, let you know what's new. The second thing is to stress the importance of incorporating NSCD into your LCSMs. There's various different methods to measure it, various methods that suit different site conditions, and so we'll talk a little bit about that. And then lastly, we'll talk about NSCD as a remediation alternative, and we have a case study here. There's three in the Appendix B of the LNAPL 3 document. So again, reference Appendix B in LNAPL 3 for more details that I won't be able to cover everything here. But the three case studies will cover one of those where it was used and accepted as an effective and sustainable remedial option for a low-risk site. So here's a conceptualization of natural source zone depletion. And the key thing here is that formerly, with monitored natural attenuation, we had focused on the groundwater zone. So in the lower right-hand corner of this figure, we're collecting samples and looking at dissolved phase concentrations of various different things, contaminants of concern or electron acceptors, for example. And really the new science is pointing us to the vadose zone. And in fact, a lot of these NSCD processes, principally biodegradation, are occurring and generating significant amounts of gases. And so with the gases generated, principally methane from methanogenesis that's occurring in the NAPL source zones, we're getting some gas diffusion and transport into the vadose zone. And you can see on this figure where the methane basically meets the oxygen diffusing from atmosphere, you get a hydrocarbon oxidation zone. And this is where the methane converts to CO2, and in fact, some heat is generated as well. So that's what we're looking at exploiting and measuring as part of the NSCD measurement processes, and then stoichiometrically converting into estimates of hydrocarbon degradation. And so over the 100-some-odd sites that have been measured at this point, we're seeing that as manifested in changes in the gases or the vadose zone, that the NSCD rates that we previously were estimating, just looking at the groundwater, significantly underestimated the total rates. And so we're finding out now that NSCD rates within our NAPL source zones are significantly larger than we thought. The key things here as part of your LCSM are temperatures, soil moisture and soil type, and also LNAPL distribution. So as far as temperature goes, there's no change from what we knew before. The warmer the climate, the higher the NSCD rates in general. What is interesting is the heat generation in that oxidation zone. So just because you're in a cold temperature climate doesn't necessarily mean you have low NSCD rates. That's an important take-home message here. Secondly is the soil types. So for soils that are finer grained or higher moisture content, we have gas diffusion limitations and gas transport limitations. And we're seeing through, again, measurements on hundreds of sites at this point, that NSCD rates can be lower at those sites with finer grained soils or wetter conditions where gases have a more difficult time moving. And then lastly, this is a typical unconfined homogeneous formation that's depicted here. And as were discussed in the prior parts of this LNAPL training series, there are other settings such as confined NAPL and perch NAPL. So in different settings such as those, expect different expressions and distributions of gases that are depicted here. So some of the new learnings. We've been measuring NSCD now for about 10 years, and over that 10-year period, we're finding that they look to be zero order. We're not seeing a lot of change over time. Granted, we're talking only a decade, but seeing very little changes in those rates. And also importantly, these are bulk measures at this point. They are total petroleum hydrocarbons. And so we are not at the point of estimating NSCD rates that are chemical specific quite yet. Also, direct biodegradation. So this is a topic that was raised in LNAPL 1 in the 2009 document. And since that time, a fair amount of information has come out in the literature. This is called direct contact oil biodegradation. And you can see by the electron microscopy photo here at the bottom of this slide that people are seeing oil droplets inside Pseudomonas bacteria cell structures, providing direct evidence that where the prior understanding was that NAPL or non-aqueous phase liquid had to solubilize first and then in order to be biodegraded, has sort of bust that prior understanding. So that now explains how we can have such high NSCD rates. This oil is being directly biodegraded by the microorganisms. And the last component of the slide is the chart on the right-hand side. And this shows basically the N-alkyl cyclohexane contents of various LNAPL samples across a site at Bemidji in Minnesota, a highly studied site. The solid line across or curve across the top of all of this is the fresh starting oil content of the various different carbon compounds moving from left to right in order of increasing carbon numbers. And what you can quickly see is that the degradation that is occurring is actually more significant in the C20 range than it is, let's say, in the C12 range. Again, providing more evidence that biodegradation of these compounds is occurring not just in the soluble small carbon number compounds, but also in the larger. So with that theory and basis, how do you use natural source zone depletion? Well, one way is to understand NAPL body stability. So NAPL bodies, we now know through experience over the years that they typically stabilize after a reasonably short amount of time after release. And what we've seen now and what we understand now is it's natural source on depletion that's really acting to control the spread of these LNAPL releases. And it is analogous to a glacier on a mountainside. So equate evaporation and melting of your ice or your glacier to NSCD processes. You have the counteracting forces of the gradient, let's say the slope of the mountainside versus the gradient or head on the LNAPL release, and then the counteracting force of natural source zone depletion or evaporation and melting. So this is a very good analogy where we see recession of NAPL plumes at the terminus edge of this glacier, let's say, where you could install a monitoring well, see stained soils, but no accumulation of NAPL in your wells. Essentially, natural source zone depletion acts to reduce saturations over time to a residual phase. So a really great way to understand stability. The next way is to understand practicability of recovery and use as an endpoint metric for LNAPL remediation. So either as a leading metric or a lagging metric, you can use NSCD rates as a quantitative means to understand how effective your remedial systems are. So on the right-hand part of this slide are some published data that is out there in the literature. The median horizontal line here of 1,700 gallons per acre per year comes from Garga et al., published last year. So across the, you know, again, hundreds of sites where this has been measured, we're seeing on average about 1,700 gallons per acre per year loss due to NSCD forces. And so when you compare that to rates of remediation from other types of LNAPL systems that Tom and then Lloyd will eventually talk about as well, skimming systems or aeration systems, you can see that the rates of NSCD fall right in the middle. So the key point here is use of NSCD rates can be useful to assess or optimize your remedial strategies or also use them as an endpoint metric for systems that you're looking to install. And then lastly is using NSCD as a benchmark for enhancing NSCD. So, you know, in various different conversations I've had, it comes to the point of, okay, great, natural processes, NSCD is doing such and such, say 1,000 gallons per acre per year. How do you speed it up? And so the cool thing here is that the new NSCD science is opening the realm of remedial technologies up to enhanced processes, aeration, enhanced anaerobic, as well as heating. So let's look at the four different ways to measure NSCD. If you found something really struck a chord in the prior series of slides and you want to go out there and measure NSCD rates at your sites, you have various different options. Appendix B has lots of details about how to do that. And I'm just going to summarize them quickly here. The first is the gradient method on the left-hand side. It's basically using soil gas vapor monitoring probes and a landfill gas meter. And so you're measuring soil gas concentrations with depth and then plotting those profiles and using Fick's law to understand what the flux of either oxygen usage or CO2 transport in the vadose zone, and then estimating your NSCD rates that way. So it's a subsurface method. The second method and the third as well are both ground surface-based methods. This second is the passive flux trap, a nice photo here from eFlux LLC, who provides the materials. This is a trap that essentially sits on the ground. It's various different diameters. The one depicted here is 4-inch diameter. It's got a sorbent material inside of it that traps CO2 migrating upwards through the trap over that 2-week deployment period. That trap is sent back to the laboratory, the carbon extracted, radiocarbon dating, 14C analysis can also be used on this to do background correction. So a key message here is that when you're measuring NSCD and focusing perhaps on CO2 or oxygen consumption, there are other sources of CO2 and other processes that are natural soil respiration related, for example, that you have to account and essentially subtract from. And so 14C analysis through the trap method has been one way that particular method has really differentiated itself. The third method is the chamber method, the dynamic closed chamber. a nice image here showing the yellow box, which essentially contains a pump and an infrared gas analyzer. The pump circulates gases through the white chamber that's sitting atop, in this particular case, an 8-inch PVC soil collar. Both of these methods, traps and chambers, a very shallow install on the order of 3 inches deep is all. And so that measures the accumulation over about a 90-second period of time within that chamber, and then that rate of change of CO2 concentration, again, then it can be converted to a CO2 flux, and that CO2 flux is then stoichiometrically backed into an NSCD, or hydrocarbon biodegradation rate. So the key thing with the chamber is that that's a snapshot in time. The passive flux trap is a time-integrated sample over about a two-week period. And then lastly is the biogenic heat. So various different creative smart minds have come up with different ways to estimate NSCD rates from the delta T. So within your subsurface, if you measure an area of NSCD and then also measure an area of just background, non-impacted soils, you can take a look at the temperature differentiation or difference between those two locations and come up with a delta T. And from that delta T, you can then use various thermodynamic equations, Fourier's law, and heats of reaction of biodegradation to estimate your NSCD rates that way. So four different ways presented in LNAPL3 to measure your NSCD rates. So with that, let's go through a case study. So again, this is a case study that is in the LNAPL3 document. Intended to illustrate how, in this particular case, how one might transition from an active system to natural source zone depletion in a treatment train approach, such as Tom Fox described. So this particular site was a jet fuel pipeline release site in a soil type with silty clay overburden overlying a fine-grained sand. The conceptual site model depiction is shown on the right-hand side. In red is the LNAPL smear zone, and you can pretty quickly see that it's submerged. So at this particular site, water use, local groundwater use had changed, and pumping had ceased, and water levels rose on the order of 10 to 20 feet. So despite that submergence, we were able to implement various different remedial strategies during the lower water table time, skimming and SEE. And since that time, the water table had rose and decreased those recovery rates from those systems. So we were able to get about 20,000 gallons out of the ground during approximately 10 years of operation of those systems, and had reached a point of diminishing returns, and were really seeking a more cost-effective remedy to implement. So this transition is a common occurrence on our LNAPL remediation sites. So the LNAPL 3 document, again, Appendix B, has various different tools to help project teams go through these processes. And so here's one of the flow charts that's depicted in figure NSCD 15 that helps teams assemble essentially multiple lines of evidence to pull together some rationale to help make that decision. A couple of key entry points here, though, is the assumption for this particular flow chart that no pre-existing criteria had been established, and that there is a regulatory pathway. So really important that there's some initial discussions with the regulatory agencies to discuss this process of transition ahead of time and gain some consensus on how we're going to do this. Now, the ITRC document leverages the National Research Council 2013 process, where they decided that there were three different categories of evidence that you can compile to help make this decision. In a lower middle part of this flow chart, it shows the risk reduction considerations, technical feasibility considerations, as well as cost. And then those are brought together to help assess the weight of evidence and whether the transition is appropriate or not. So the project team in this case followed that process and compiled the lines of evidence shown on this slide. So from a risk reduction perspective, it was determined there was no threat of LNAPL or dissolved plume migration. The land use atop which the LNAPL plume exists was all industrial land, strictly legally enforced through various different covenants and things. From a technical perspective, we did the measurements and saw that NSVD was doing an order of magnitude greater than our LNAPL skimming and SVE systems were doing. Additionally, again, as discussed in prior parts of this training, LNAPL transmissivity was measured and found to be below the 0.1 square feet per day recommended threshold. And then lastly was the stability of the plumes. So with all of that weight of evidence, we didn't even need to look at the cost. We determined that it was appropriate to transition and time to move on to NSED. And now we're looking at a scenario where we're doing long-term NSED monitoring, possibly with a biogenic heat method. So that's it. Wrapping up the natural source zone depletion, some of the take-home points. It's occurring at most, if not all, of our sites. It's a phase change technology that's resulting in composition change as well as saturation reduction, and it's appropriate and I think valuable to incorporate into your LCSMs. There's many different methods to measure it. Depending on your site conditions, that's going to drive which of the methods you select. It's an effective, accepted, and sustainable option for low-risk sites, and it's viable as a standalone or a transition remedy. So with that, Juliana, if you could put up the last poll, let's take a look at how folks think of NSCD. So the question here is, why is it important to understand NSCD at your petroleum remediation site? Let's just take a second to fill that out. Yeah, kind of a loaded question, all the above. I think if you get one thing out of this component of the training, it's the fact that measurement of NSCD has various different uses at your sites that can be quite valuable and help you optimize your remedies. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Lloyd Dunlop with Trihydro, and he's going to describe a plethora of additional remedial technologies. Over to you, Lloyd.
Well, thank you. Well, hello, everybody. Now, as Tom mentioned earlier, technologies are broadly grouped into the document on how they address LNAPL concerns. Now, we use this ternary diagram on the lower right to help identify how a technology can actually address the concern. Now, for example, so if LNAPL migration is your concern, mass control technologies are probably your first group of technologies to look at. Now, your goal could be, for example, contain LNAPL at a defined boundary. Now, if LNAPL saturation, though, if that is your concern, now you want to focus on mass recovery technologies. Your example goal could be abate LNAPL migration by removal of LNAPL mass. And finally, if LNAPL residual or compositional effects is your concern, then you want to focus on phase change technologies. Your goal could be abate contaminants emanating from the LNAPL source. Now, as we talked about, technology groups can overlap. So this means that some technologies can serve more than one group. Now, this is good because they can address several LNAPL states at one time. But technologies that don't overlap may be useful in the treatment trains or in combination of other technologies to enhance or accelerate cleanup. And as Tom discussed, we can use these technologies as a treatment train or even combine them together. Now, here are the technologies that we have put into the 2018 guidance document. So the green are the technologies that have been added to this guidance. And we're going to briefly talk about these 21. Okay, here is another way to list technologies within their groups of either phase change on the top, mass control on the right, or mass recovery on the lower left. And as we've said, some technologies fit within more than one group. Now, an example is phytotechnology and activated carbon, which can fit within both the phase change and mass control. Now, we're first going to be talking about mass control technologies. Mass control technologies typically contain the LNAPL at a defined boundary. Now, mass control technologies are typically physical containment or hydraulic containment. Now, you can see some examples here that I'm sure you've likely recognized. But another mass control technology is in situ soil mixing or stabilization. But other technologies that can be used as mass control are listed here also. Now, we're going to refer to the ternary diagram on the lower right to demonstrate what objectives are being used for each technology. So the dot on the lower right shows that the remedial objective is MC, meaning mass control. Now, to learn more about these technologies, I'm going to continually refer you back to tables 6.1 and 6.2 and 6.3 and Appendix A in the guidance document. That's where you're going to find your most information. Now, here are some example performance metrics for mass control technologies. For example, you do not detect LNAPL in the downgradient well. Or another one is the LNAPL body has stabilized. Other metrics, example metrics, can be found in tables 5.2 and 6.3 in the guidance document. Now, let's walk through an example how to select a technology. So let's say you have a site where LNAPL is migrating toward a river. From the process we learned in session 2, our concern can be labeled as LNAPL migrating into a river. Now, this process is found in Table 5.1 of the guidance document. And you could state next, your goal is LNAPL saturation based. We want to stop the LNAPL migration. Next, we review the remedy LCSM to or update it, which we'll probably might need to do. What might you need to know? There may be other considerations that you have now to influence the LNAPL site conceptual model and remedy selection, such as you may have results of testing or modeling or bench scale or pilot scale tests or other factors, which including you may even have additional costs and liability concerns. So therefore you want to look at your remedy LCSM to update it. Now, more about this is found in Table 4.4. Now, next, we have our SMART objective. It is to use, for this example, the SMART objective could be use a physical barrier to stop the migration. And remember, SMART stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. Now, more about this can be found in Table 5.1 and also in Sections 5.3 and 5.6. Now, next, we select a technology that provides mass control. Now, the list of technologies within mass control are either physical or hydraulic containment, but other technologies are listed here also. Next, you align your technology with the site conditions using Table 6.3, and then Appendix A gives you more details about the technology. Now, as we continue with this example, we next go then to our design and our performance LCSM. What we're going to do, we're going to design and engineer the technology to meet the goals. And then we evaluate the performance and set metrics. Now, some SMART metrics in this example could be no first LNAPL occurrence in a downgradient well, or no sheen detected in the river. Now, other metrics that you can use or refer to can be found in the guidance document in tables 5.2 and 6.3. And Tom and Joanne will outline a case study in a few minutes that will give further details on these concepts. Okay, next we're going to talk about specific mass recovery technologies. Okay, now the most familiar to you are likely skimming or excavation, SESR, or water flooding. As you can see, some technologies like total liquid extraction are both mass recovery and mass control. So for the mass recovery, some examples of SMART objectives could be recover the LNAPL to a practical limit, or always a good one, LNAPL transmissivity. So remember, for mass recovery, we want to recover the LNAPL by removal of the LNAPL mass. Now, with mass recovery, what we are doing, we are addressing the saturation-based LNAPL remediation goals. Now, these technologies recover LNAPL via either physical removal, such as excavation, or of LNAPL saturated soils, or another example is fluid recovery, like LNAPL pumping and skimming. So here is our ternary diagram on the lower left. Now, the dot indicates we are now talking about mass recovery technologies. Okay, so the simple fluid recovery technologies like skimming or total liquid extraction, and this is formerly called dual pump liquid extraction. You have vacuum enhanced skimming or vacuum enhanced fluid recovery and multi-phase extraction. Now, we all know what excavation is. Excavation can also remove residuals, but it is limited to what you can reach. And to learn more about these, again, refer to Table 6.1, 6.2, and 6.3, and Appendix A. Okay, now let me give you some higher level examples of other mass control technologies. Let's first talk about water flooding. Now, water flooding, without using hot water, that only increases the gradient. But if you use hot water in your flooding, that also reduces the viscosity. Next, we're going to talk about surfactant enhanced subsurface remediation, or SESR, and also coal solvent flushing. Now, these are chemical processes. You can see here the advantages, disadvantages, and engineering requirements. So some of the advantages may be a shorter time frame. A disadvantage may be that you now have a waste stream to treat. In engineering, you need to also engineer that radius of influence. And on the ternary diagram, you can see that the dots are in between mass recovery and phase change, which means they can actually serve two different. Now let's look at some example performance metrics. So here are some examples. Other metrics are found in tables 5.2 and 6.3. That is always a good place to go back and look for other example metrics in the guidance document. For example, the LNAPL transmissivity is low, making recovery ineffective. That could be one of your metrics. On the graph, if you look at the left-hand column, you can see that the decline curve analysis to indicate whether the system has reached its effectiveness. And on the right side, the y-axis, the unit cost of incremental mass recovery can be a metric. Now, the cost in some cases may outweigh the benefits of the amount of LNAPL recovered. And the graphic shows the dollars per gallon for LNAPL removed. As you know, as systems approach their endpoint, less LNAPL is recovered, while O&M costs may remain the same or even increase, thus increasing the cost of LNAPL removal as measured in dollars per gallon. And then next, we're going to talk about phase change technologies. You've heard of these, like BioSparge and BioVent, NSCD, or ISCO, or Enhanced Anaerobic Degradation, and Air Sparge and SVE. Now, as we said, some of these technologies fit within more than one group. An example, as you see here, is phytotechnology and activated carbon can fit within both phase change and mass control. NPE, in the very center, is a technology that fits into all three groups. That is why it is often a very successful technology. Now, recall the coffee cup steam that Tom showed earlier. Now, phase change technologies do not directly remove LNAPL, as do the mass recovery technologies. Instead, LNAPL phase change technologies change the LNAPL to other phases. It does this by increasing the rates of volatilization and dissolution and degradation of the LNAPL constituents. Now, for phase change technologies, an example goal could be abate the vapor concentrations in the soil, or abate the vapor intruding into a building by depleting volatile constituents in the LNAP. Another one could be you can reduce LNAP groundwater dissolved concentrations at a point of compliance by removing the soluble constituents from the LNAP. An example of that is reducing benzene in the LNAP to reduce the benzene concentration moving into the groundwater. Now let's look at some ambient phase change technologies. Notice the dot on the ternary is now on the top, indicating phase change or PC. Now the ambient technologies are NSVD that Tom just talked about, air sparge and SVE, and biosparging. MPE and phytotechnologies can also be a phase change technology. Now here's an example of air sparging and soil vapor extraction. Above the water table, LNAP is removed through soil vapor extraction, while below the water table, air sparging removes the constituents in the LNAP. Now here are some example smart metrics for phase change technologies. For example, the first one up there, the dissolved phase concentration is stable or decreasing. Another one could be the soil concentrations are stable or decreasing. Another one is you can see the asymptotic performance of the recovery system, or volatile or soluble constituents of concern are reduced to a regulatory-based standard in your immediate concern. Other metrics that you can look at are suggested in 5.2 and 6.3. Now let's look at some in situ thermal technologies. Now these are both mass recovery and phase change. As you can see, the dot on the ternary diagram is in between MR and PC. So the photo is an example of steam or hot air injection. Other technologies out there are in situ smoldering, which is primarily a combustion process, thermal conduction heating, and electrical resistance heating. Now you can find out more about these technologies in table 6.1 through 6.3 and also Appendix A. Now these in situ technologies increase the LNAP volatility and reduce the viscosity. Now for these technologies, both SVE for volatilized LNAP and hydrox recovery is also likely needed. And also, they're typically better in low groundwater velocity settings. Now here are some example metrics for in-situ thermal technologies. They are similar to the other technologies you talked about. The first one we list up there is LNAP transmissivity. It's always a good one. You can have soil concentrations or dissolved phase concentrations at regulatory standards. And also, like we discussed, cost per unit volume removed and asymptotic curve for mass removal. Just make sure you refer to the tables 5.2 and 6.3 in the guidance document. So now you have a snapshot of the 21 technologies, their groupings, and how to select them. You can find out a lot more about these technologies in the guidance document. Next, I'm going to turn it over to Tom Fox from the Colorado Division of Oil and Gas and Public Safety. But we may have a question and answer period coming up here.
Thanks, Lloyd. We are going to take a short break for questions. Everyone in the audience is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. I'll also take a moment here to remind all of our participants that we are looking for your feedback. Even if you provided feedback to part one and part two, we would like your feedback for part three. At the end of the training, we'll have a link on the slide. If you do leave before we wrap up, in the related links on the middle right, if you scroll down, you'll see the feedback. It's a two-step process to get those to work. You select the name, and then you look down a bit, select Browse To, and that link is going to open in a new window for you. So we do ask that you fill out the feedback form. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. So if that's something you can use, You are welcome to complete the feedback form, and then once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended if you're interested in the certificate. We've had several questions that came in related to the NSDD. How much temperature difference do you see?
Yeah, I can answer that, Juliana. Typically, we're seeing between 1 and 5 degrees C at these sites. There are some sites where we've seen some higher numbers, such as 10 degrees C. However, at those sites, there are other remedial systems going on, such as aeration, that tends to increase temperatures even more than the ambient NSED processes. So in general, between 1 and 5 degrees C.
How much monitoring do you need to establish NSED rates? 1 month, half a year, a full year, more?
Yeah. Good question. It really depends, is the answer. We've got some guidance in the Appendix B that walks you through establishing data objectives. So again, just like the multiple options for measurement, the methods, there's also multiple options for the extent of monitoring. So it can range from a snapshot or a spot check in time where you're going out there and just kind of doing an initial screening of rates to see where you fall in that typical spectrum, all the way to a more robust monitoring plan where you're monitoring a couple of times a year, looking at changes from seasonality. So we do see rates sometimes an order of magnitude different between colder seasons versus the warmer, end of the summer, even early fall time of the year. So again, depending on what you're using the data for, if you're using it to really determine a full-scale remedy for your site, then you're going to need a little more robust of a monitoring program.
What's the best method for measuring NSCD at paved sites?
Right. Paved sites, obviously, you're forced into a scenario of using the subsurface methods, either gradient or biogenic heat. If you poke a hole in the pavement, you're going to see an outrush of gases. And so that is obviously not representative of sort of the natural gas flux that's occurring. You'll get really, really high biased, for example, CO2 flux measurements. So we will instantly, focus on the subsurface methods of gradient and biogenic heat.
Is there a rule of thumb for how many NSC measurements are required? Is it plume size driven, depth to LNAPL driven?
Yeah. There's no rules of thumb. I'll go back to the data objectives and discussions with the regulatory agencies in terms of the data use. Obviously, the more intensive programs are geared towards the data sets that are going to be used to change or make decisions. If you're maybe just adding an element to your conceptual site model, then you can probably get away with fewer locations of monitoring, for example. So again, it's a site-specific, really phase, project phase-specific decision on numbers of locations and measurements and things.
Thanks. Moving on to our technology section, one of our participants says that he's recently gotten back into remediation activities, but he thought it was standard practice not to air sparge if LNAPL is present. Has that changed?
Yes, I think it has. If you go back to the guidance document, that used to be something that was referred to as to remove all the LNAPL first, but common thinking today is that you can air sparge into LNAPL.
Thanks. Our next question refers to slide 63, so I'm going to try to jump back there. Are those performance metrics valid in the presence of measurable free product? Oh, jump back way too far.
Are these valid on the, with measurable free product? Well, yes, if you're at number one there, if you're looking at your concentrations? Yes, it would be. Soil concentrations? Yes, if you have concentrations that are stable and decreasing. And your isotopic performance of the recovery system or and involved constituents from have been reduced to risk-based standards in your groundwater plume. It all depends on what your goals are. It all depends on what your concerns are. So going through that remedy LCSM and your design performance metrics, LCSM, you can take a look at these kind of things and make sure your metrics are going to fit with your site.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and continue on with the second half of the training. I know we have quite a few NSDB questions that we haven't answered yet, but Tom is doing a great job of answering those online, so watch for those answers to come up in your Q&A if you asked a question. Also, throughout the second half, you are welcome to send in questions. Using that Q&A box, we are going to try to have time at the end of today's class to answer more questions. So now I am going to turn it over to Tom Fox at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Tom?
Hello, everybody. I'm back again. I want to take just a couple minutes to refresh our point in time here. And let's take another look at this flow chart to remind us where we are in the management strategy presented in the document. The previous two training sessions, we covered how to determine what you have and what needs to be done. And now we're into how to address it and which technologies to select to address it. The objectives for this portion of the training are to learn the technology selection process and ultimately to be able to apply the guidance from start to finish to a real site. And this should incorporate all three trainings that you've been part of, I hope. So we're going to take about the next few minutes to review a little bit, and then we're going to be jumping into a case study. We're going to start with learning the technology selection process, a quick overview. So trainings 1 and 2 covered this portion of the flow diagram that you're familiar with, which is figure 1-1 out of the document. And our training today is focusing on this portion of the document outlined in red. So you'll see we'll cover topics including LCSM design and performance portions, and also operating the remedy and choosing metrics and endpoints. Here's a portion of the process flow diagram, and this is figure 6-1 in the guidance. It has more details added to show you that each box in the diagram can represent more than one action. This is very much of an interactive process. The remedial technology selection process involves a preliminary screening, which is shown here in the purple section, that measures the effectiveness of technologies. The goal of step one is to identify all possible LNAPL technologies that might be useful at your site from the list of 21 technologies that Lloyd has talked about and that are presented in the guidance. Step one uses your site-specific LNAPL concerns, remedial goals, and remediation objectives along with table 6-3 in the document to determine a subset of technologies that might fit your site. So all the information from the three training classes come together when it's time to determine a technology that might be useful for you. In step two, you reevaluate your LCSM based on your list of technologies from step one and determine whether it needs updating. This may include collecting additional data or further evaluating your goals and objectives. And in step three, which is at the lower portion of that purple box, you further screen the technologies in your list based on site-specific geologic factors and information found in the A-series tables in Appendix A. And this completes your preliminary screening, hopefully leaving a short list of possible technologies to consider further. This initial screening is followed by an implementation step. And by this, you're going to be using the B-series tables in Appendix A. The remaining steps that are shown here in red evaluate the technologies for implementation using the C-series tables in Appendix A. So keep in mind that there are several points throughout the technology selection process that you need to reevaluate your LCSM and update it as necessary as information becomes available. So let's talk a little bit more about Appendix A. This is very important. This is where all the technologies are gathered together for you to review. Appendix A contains three different types of tables for each technology. These tables are called the A, B, and C series tables. And like I said, the A series tables contain general information about each technology and the geologic conditions under which that technology might be applicable. The B series tables list more factors to use in evaluating the technology on your site, and we'll be reviewing those a little bit later. And the C series table will contain technical information to consider before actually using a technology. These tables are a really good place to start if you want to learn about a specific technology, but we'll show you how to use the information during the remedy selection process to help you narrow the list of possible technologies. So that was a quick overview of the technology selection process, and now we're going to go through a case study. It'll take about another 35 or so minutes so we can show you how to apply the document to a real site and the details of each of those steps. And here to help me with that is Joanne Dyson with WCEC. Joanne, I'm a regulator, and I'm interested in knowing more about this LNAPL site that you've remediated and how you use this LNAPL process as a consultant. Can you tell me about it?
Sure, Tom. I'd be happy to discuss the project with you. First, I'll tell you a little bit about the site. This was an active filling station with a small convenience store. And in 2000, a leak was discovered that was determined to be a piping leak from a gasoline underground storage tank. Through groundwater monitoring over several years, we knew that the water table was typically 5 to 6 feet below surface grade, but it fluctuated as much as 2.5 feet above and below this level. Now, groundwater flow was observed to mainly be to the east and southeast, but it was also observed to be to the northeast. The dissolved phase contaminants of concern at the site that were above regulatory limits were BTEX, MTBE, and 1,2-dichloroethane, or 1,2-DCA. There are apartments and residences surrounding the station, and the residences all have basements and sump pumps. In addition, there's an alley that runs between, the station and the apartments that has the utility corridor in it. So all of this information was used to build our initial LCSM for the site. And Section 4 of the LNAPL guidance discusses the evolution of the LCSM through corrective action. And in Section 4.2 provides key questions to guide the development of the initial LCSM. And it includes questions such as, is the source and extent of the LNAPL known? Are dissolved or vapor plumes characterized? And are exposure pathways complete? So at this point in our investigation, the source appeared to be limited to the tank basin area. So that would be right in this area. And the plume was, we had characterized the dissolved phase plume. The source area was likely larger at one time based on the size of the dissolved phase plume, which is shown in this blue color. And since vapors were a concern, we referred to the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion document, or the PVI document. Section 3.3 of that document shows that we would need a vertical separation of at least 5 feet between the building foundation and the water table due to the dissolved phase plume to say that we have an incomplete pathway and that no further investigation would be needed. So at this site, our water table was typically 5 to 6 feet below grade, but it fluctuated. So the vertical separation, our vertical separation was too small to discount vapor intrusion at the site, especially since the basements are approximately 6 feet below grade in the area. So since we needed to learn more about the exposure pathways, we started monitoring vapor below the apartment building and soil gas near the downgraded residences. So about 3 years after groundwater monitoring, LNAPL appeared in monitoring well one, which is really near the tank basin area, with thicknesses that were always less than a half a foot. And with this new observation, we clearly needed to define the extent of LNAPL outside the tank basin and redevelop our LCSM. So we performed an LIF investigation to delineate the source and determine the extent of LNAPL. So this investigation indicated that we had an LNAPL body that was in the source area and to the southeast towards the alley with LNAPL that was at a depth of about 8 feet below surface grade. About 8 years after the release, LNAPL was observed down gradient in this off-site monitoring well, MW4, with at thicknesses of up to about 8 feet, 0.8 feet. We noticed that this occurred when the water table at the site had dropped 3 to 5 feet. So we did an additional LIF investigation to see if we could determine if LNAPL had migrated in the past from MW1 to MW4 and was now just being exposed by the dropping water table, or if LNAPL was migrating during the current low water table conditions. So this additional LIF investigation actually showed that LNAPL, we saw LNAPL in the logs along this pathway from MW1 that were not previously observed. So this indicated that LNAPL had actually migrated under current low water table from around the area around MW1 to this residential property to the southeast. So we already knew that we had potential vapor intrusion issues and risks at the adjacent apartments and the nearby residences from dissolved phase contamination. But now we also knew that there was a new potential risk of LNAPL in the basements or the sumps at these downgradient residences, especially if migration continued. So referring back to the question in 4.2, the guidance about LNAPL source and extent, we now knew that the LNAPL body was not stable but migrating to the southeast, so our extent was actually unknown at this point. This plan view shows the LNAPL plume that we determined during the LIF investigations, and the red indicates the most saturated area, and the green are the least saturated areas. So we're going to look at two cross-sections of the site so we can see the site geology and the vertical distribution of the LNAPL. So we'll look at one, the first one we'll look at is from west to east on the site, and notice that it's going to go through the plume, through the LNAPL plume and near the apartment. A cross-section of the site that goes from west to east across the site. And here's monitoring well one, and the alley, and the apartments. And we're looking at the LNAPL plume here below monitoring well one and below the tank basin area. And this view shows the width of the LNAPL plume, and it's the view is as if the LNAPL is migrating out of the page towards us. And here's the high water table and the low water table. And the geology at the site, we have mainly clay-rich till all throughout the site. But then also spread throughout the site, we have these sand lenses that were found between 5 and 26 feet below grade. And the sand lenses are anywhere from 4 inches thick to 5 feet thick. So then our next cross-section, so this view shows us, here's monitoring well 1, monitoring well 4, and the alley in the middle, and this view is along the migration pathway, so we're looking at it from the side. So again, our high water table and low water table, and then you can see some of these bigger sand lenses in this view. So you can see this migration that occurred from monitoring well 1 to monitoring well 4, and notice the smear zone in around monitoring well 4, it's mainly just in the lower part of the water table.
Well, Joanne, it looks like you developed a pretty thorough LCSM for this site. I know the first step in remediation selection is to determine the remedial goals and objectives based on site concerns and use those along with Table 6.3 to develop a subset of technologies. So this step uses concepts that were developed in trainings 1 and 2. So from a regulator's perspective, it looks like there are a lot of concerns for this site involved in the protection of human health and the environment. Can you take me through the first screening step for your site?
Sure. So there were several concerns at this site. We had mobile LNAPL that was migrating to the southeast during periods of low groundwater, We also had dissolved phase contamination that was above regulatory limits, and we had potential vapor intrusion issues. So although it wasn't a concern, an additional factor that we had to consider at the site was that this site was added to the aggressive site cleanup status by a regulatory agency. So that was another thing that we had to keep in mind.
Okay, Juliana, let's do a quick poll of our audience. So at this point in the case study, which concern would you consider to be the highest priority for the site? Would it be A, migrating LNAPL, B, a large dissolved plume with above regulatory limits for BTECs, MTBE, and DCA, or C, vapor plume and vapor intrusion risks to offsite properties? Looks like most people are looking at vapor intrusion. And we'll give it another minute for a few more votes. Okay, Juliana, would you end that? It's decisively for C, vapor plume and vapor intrusion risks. Joanne, what did you decide for this site?
So we decided to concentrate on the migrating LNAPL, knowing that in addition to the risk of the LNAPL itself possibly entering basements or the sumps, that this migrating LNAPL could actually create higher dissolve phase and vapor intrusion risks at the downgradient residences if this migration did continue. And we also realized that it may be possible to address more than one concern if with the right technology. So let's look at how we address that. So let's go back to table 6.3, and this is an example of the preliminary screening matrix table. The columns that are included in this table are the remedial goals, the remediation objective, technology groups, and then possible technologies to use at the site. We also have applicable site conditions, and in the full table, there's actually an additional column off to the right that I didn't include just for the viewing purposes that shows potential metrics that we'll discuss later. So for step one, we determined at the site that our remedial goal was to terminate the LNAPL body migration and reduce potential for LNAPL migration. And for this goal, we had two different options for objectives, remediation objectives. And the remediation objective we chose was to abate the LNAPL body migration by sufficient physical removal of mobile LNAPL mass. And to achieve this goal, we would need technologies that are in the LNAPL mass recovery group. And that included excavation, skimming, vacuum-enhanced skimming, total liquid extraction, and MPE. So these were the technologies that we initially considered. So even though the full list of geologic factors that we could use later and detailed information about these technologies are in the A-series tables in Appendix A, Table 6.3 summarizes these factors under this applicable site conditions, and it provides a first screening step. So the applicable site conditions that we can look at just using Table 6.3 are geology, whether you have fine or coarse-grained soils at your site, the impacted zone, whether the zone is whether your LNAPL is in the unsaturated or the saturated zone, and the type of LNAPL that you have. Is it a low volatility, low solubility LNAPL, or high volatility, high solubility LNAPL? Since our site was mainly fine-grained, we were able to use this table and use the geology section here to look at these different five technologies, and we mainly had a fine-grained site. So we can see that two of these technologies, skimming and total liquid extraction, are not as applicable in those conditions. So we discontinued looking at skimming and total liquid extraction for our site. So we had three technologies left at this point. We have excavation, vacuum-enhanced skimming, and multi-phase extraction.
Well, it sounds like you made a good decision to eliminate skimming and total liquid extraction, and I want to emphasize that this is just the first screening step to deal with one of the concerns at this site. I know a lot of you had recognized in the poll that vapor intrusion was a risk, and this is something that, of course, Joanne would come back to later in the process. So I'm assuming, Joanne, you reevaluated your LCSM at this stage, and we certainly don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. And when we reevaluate our LCSM, it adds an extra layer of comfort, especially to me as a regulator, to ensure protection of human health and the environment. So this is the next step in the technology screening process. Was your LCSM thorough enough to move forward with the three remaining technologies?
Yeah, so section 4.4 of the LNAPL guidance has key questions for developing the remedy selection LCSM. And those questions range from some general topics to more LNAPL specific topics. Some of the questions focus on the source, such as where is it and how is it distributed above and below the water table, and includes other questions such as what's achievable for a given technology. So after reviewing these topics, we determined that we did not have to collect any additional field data at this point to move forward. We had already completed two LIF investigations in addition to some other investigations, and we had the data that we needed. And some of the elements of our current LCSM that were important for remedy selection included knowing that the permeability at the site was low and that the source was submerged below the water table.
We're both pushing buttons. Okay, so now step three of the selection process is to screen the remaining possible technologies from step one using geologic factors in the A-series tables from Appendix A. And I know you've already screened them somewhat on base geology, but were you able to narrow down your list of the three technologies based on some additional site geologic factors?
Yes, those tables were helpful. So in addition to geologic factors, the A-series tables also just have some general information about the technologies. So here's an example of the A-series table for vacuum-enhanced skimming. And the top is condensed here for easier reading, but you can see that there is a description of technology, remediation process, objective applicability, and then applicable LNAPL type. And then the geologic factors are at the bottom of the table. And this includes information for the saturated and the unsaturated zone. And it includes specific information for permeability, for grain size, heterogeneity, and consolidation for each of those zones. So in particular, the information about the saturated zone permeability was beneficial for us in our screening process. So the permeability description told us that vacuum-enhanced skimming would be more successful in higher permeable soils. And although LNAPL at the site is in the higher permeable lenses, most of the site has lower permeability soil. So based on this, we determined that vacuum-enhanced skimming was not a good fit for the site. And we repeated this geologic screening for the other two technologies on the short list and decided that they both were applicable to the site. So after this preliminary screening process, we had excavation and multi-phase extraction left to consider.
So if you only had one technology left after the preliminary screening process, you would have needed to reevaluate your site goals or objectives. And if you still only had one technology, this next evaluation here might have been used to identify any showstopper concerns or critical concerns before moving forward with that technology. So this step involves further evaluation of the technologies that you still have on your shortlist using evaluation factors on table 6-4 in the document and the B-series tables. Here are the 9 evaluation factors that are from the guidance document in table 6-4. The next step in the process involves reviewing these evaluation factors and ranking the top 4 to 6 of these based on your site considerations, then using the B series tables to compare the technologies. So here's an example from Table 6.4 for site restrictions. Table 6.4 defines each evaluation factor and gives general examples of possible impacts to selecting a technology. So Joanne, what evaluation factors were important for your site?
So we decided that the four factors that were the most important for this site were remedial time frame, site restrictions, waste stream management, and safety, and we gave them this priority, even though they're all important, but this was the priority that we decided. So the remedial time frame we decided was the most important because we knew the regulatory agency had placed the site on the priority cleanup status. So we knew that the remedial time frame needed to be short. The site restrictions was important because we had no sewer connections at the site. We also did not have three-phase power nearby, and there were many underground utilities in the area. Waste stream management was a factor at the site because we knew this was going to be necessary for any of the technologies that we were still considering. Vapors and noise mitigation were things that we thought we could handle at the site, but we knew this because of the size of the site, it would not easily handle a large volume of wastewater or discharge water. So we had to keep that in mind moving forward. And also safety was important because this is a small site. It's an active gas station. It's located near a highway in a residential area, so there's also foot traffic in and out of the convenience store.
Okay, so the B-Series table in Appendix A gives specific impacts of each of the 9 evaluation factors for each remedial technology. And in this example for excavation, we see that the restrictions for excavation are fairly high, and then there's a discussion that gives other details to consider.
Yep, so we considered, so to go through these evaluation factors for our site, we made a table. We have the evaluation factors that we were considering on the left, and then we have our technologies that were remaining at the top. So we took the B-Series tables and went through and looked at the evaluation factors. So for excavation, looking at that B-Series table, we included all the different level of concern for our evaluation factors, and then we did the same for multi-phase extraction. This would be really important if you did have 3 or 4 technologies that you were still considering. This would be one way to help break down that decision process. So we started to make our decision looking at the high concerns. So at this site, we knew that, so we have high concerns for the site restrictions and for the waste stream management. So for site restrictions, we have the convenience store, the underground storage tank basin is really near the plume. We have the utilities in the alley. We have the apartment building, and there's also a garage nearby. So at this site, even though the remedial time frame for excavation did have a low consideration, which was a priority, we just decided that there were too many high concerns, so we eliminated excavation from further consideration. We did note that there were no high concerns for multi-phase extraction, so we retained it for further consideration to see if it would be applicable at our site.
So the next step is to review the LCSM based on the design and performance metrics provided in the C-Series tables for multi-phase extraction. And the LCSM for a site must include knowledge related to these metrics if the technology is going to be employed. So let's take a look at those. Here's a portion of the design and performance metrics from the C-Series tables for multi-phase extraction. The examples of design metrics include the number of extraction wells and conveyance piping. Examples of performance metrics include groundwater and LNAP recovery rates and the volumes. Information related to these data requirements and metrics should be part of the LCSM since these will need to be part of the full-scale design. And then these metrics should be measured to show multi-phase extraction is successful. So Joanne, was it necessary for you to update your LCSM to use MPE?
So this is a good time to refer to the design and performance LCSM questions that are in section 6.4.1 to help us review our LCSM. And by answering these questions and determining metrics and endpoints, our site objectives are on their way to being SMART. So one of the questions in this section is, what are the conditions to be created by the selected technology that will accelerate LNAPL depletion? And for us, lowering the water table at the site was one condition that we needed to obtain. And another question is, what conditions will demonstrate the desired LNAPL changes? Considering our endpoints for technology implementation was important here. So in this case, our endpoints included reduced LNAPL occurrence and declining groundwater concentrations. We already had a lot of site information that was necessary for MP implementation, such as the depth to the bottom of the LNAPL zone that would be the target for dewatering. But we did need to update our LCSM with other information, such as the radius of influence of dewatering and vacuum extraction.
Okay, so the next step in the process is to review the minimum data requirements and the critical technology evaluation needed for any technologies remaining, which is basically multi-phase extraction. And we're going to use the C-Series tables in Appendix A. Here's an example of the C-Series table for multi-phase extraction. So examples for the minimum data requirements from MPE include determining hydraulic conductivity and transmissivity, LNAPL conductivity and transmissivity, and LNAPL characteristics. Critical technology evaluation information includes necessary bench tests and maybe even pilot testing. All of this information can be considered to further evaluate the technologies. Now, what's important is if there are no technologies, you need to go back and reevaluate the objectives or the goals and have all stakeholders come together in agreement that additional work might be necessary or not. For this case study we're discussing, there was only one technology left prior to reviewing the C-Series tables, multi-phase extraction. So Joanne, what did you do at this point?
Next, we conducted a pilot test to gather additional information as shown in the MPE C-Series table and to update our LCSM. So this included determining the radius of influence and recovery rates, which would also indicate how well MPE would work at the site and the number of wells that were needed. So we had to work with the city to have three-phase power installed for the pilot test, but the pilot test did show that MPE should be successful at the site.
So before implementing a technology, the guidance recommends establishing some SMART objectives and performance metrics. This guidance recommended starting to think about this end process when reviewing and updating the LCSM for design and performance, but it's also important to monitor the technology and constantly assess performance during implementation, and then to demonstrate that the objectives are met. So how are you going to determine performance and success at your site? Sorry, Joanne, I'm clicking too many buttons.
Okay, I got it. So before we implemented MPE, we knew that, okay, let's go. Before we implemented MPE, we knew that system sampling would be necessary to monitor system performance. So to show that objectives had been met, metrics were established, including decline curve analysis and groundwater contaminant concentration decline. So since the site was small and the LNAPL body was relatively small and time was essence, we decided to run a mobile MPE system instead of installing a full-scale system at the site. We knew that the best option for discharge water was going to be to treat it and discharge to a nearby storm drain. So an MPDES permit was needed, and we also knew that we would not be remediating all the LNAPL at the site, so our treatment train would include natural source zone depletion to treat LNAPL contamination that was remaining at the site. So once operation began, we conducted monthly system site visits so that we could collect system operation samples and monitor system performance. And in addition to the groundwater monitoring, we did continue groundwater monitoring at the site. So these graphs show gasoline range organic concentrations for both monitor well MW1 and MW4. And we started these graphs, these are from when monitoring started. So this one is actually in 2004, and this one starts in 2006. So the graphs indicate, in addition to the GROW concentrations, we also have the LNAPL time period. So LNAPL was observed in each of these wells during this time period. Another thing to note is in monitor well 4, you can see that the concentration of GROW increased once LNAPL was in the well, that once it was detected in that well. So we can see all that on these. In addition, you can see the time period that the system operated. And we can see that GROW contamination had decreased after system operation for both of the wells. So once decline curve analysis indicated that our system was no longer removing contamination efficiently, the system was shut down. And the groundwater monitoring that you see here was continued. This is for 2 years after system operation. Those GROW contamination levels remained low during that follow-up monitoring, and LNAPL noticed was no longer in either of the wells in addition to the concentrations being lower. And these were both endpoints that we had set prior to our implementation. So after this 2-year period of follow-up monitoring, the regulatory agency closed the site.
Well, thanks, Joanne, for running through that case study with us and showing how the guidance document can be applied at a real site. And I'd also like to point out that multi-phase extraction was chosen, which actually was a combined remedy to address both LNAPL, dissolve phase, and vapor phase contamination all at the same time. So that helps to address some of the initial poll concerns about vapor intrusion. So here are the takeaways to end up with our technology selection module. One, you need to have a very robust LNAPL site conceptual site model. Second, you have to decide your concerns and goals up front in consultation with all stakeholders. Third, the technology selection framework is systematic and can be followed by anybody. Fourth, you need to repeat the process for each of the concerns and goals, sometimes several times to address each goal. Fifth, you're going to be using technologies that overlap with multiple concerns and goals when possible, or you can sequence the technologies as appropriate in the treatment train. And finally, make sure you establish performance metrics so you know success when you've reached it. So, Juliana, we have one more poll here. And during the technology remediation selection process, when should the LCSM be reevaluated? And you can choose all that apply. A, an LCSM should be developed prior to starting the remediation selection process. B, it should be developed during the preliminary screening process. C, after further screening with the evaluation factors. Or D, after remediation if remediation is unsuccessful. So we'll leave that open for a few more minutes. Everybody can weigh in on the question. All right, looks like A is trending ahead pretty strongly. And Juliana, why don't you end the poll there? Was it that D was actually falling behind a little bit? And I want you to understand that D is very important, and D was reviewing your LCSM after remediation if it's unsuccessful, because an unsuccessful remediation attempt also gives you information about the site, information that obviously you didn't know about before, or you would have tried to gather it in order to implement a successful remediation attempt. So always looking at your LCSM is very important. All right, moving on. You've seen this figure before. And this is the end of our LNAPL update webinar series. And as I've mentioned before, it's important that you take this knowledge and apply it at your LNAPL sites and use the ITRC guidance to improve your efforts. and select appropriate cleanup techniques. So today I'd like to thank you for your attention and your attendance today, and we hope you've learned something useful. Juliana?
Thank you. We are going to have a final question and answer break, and everyone is welcome to send questions using that Q&A in the lower right. We also have a couple final poll questions to fill out as we're going through this question and answer break. On the slide, you see the links to additional resources. This is a great place to go to download the presentations for all three parts of today's training class, if that's something you're interested in. We also ask everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the feedback. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. So once you fill out the feedback form, look for the box at the bottom that says you certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. So you can get a certificate for all three parts of today's training. Looking at the poll question, our question on the bottom left, after attending this three-part training on Elm Apples, are you ready to select remedial technologies to achieve objectives? And we'll leave this open as we're going through the questions, and you can see other answers that are available that are coming in. And also on the right, thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? And you're welcome to scroll down and see the answers as they come in. It's a great way to see what other people are going to do with this training and associated ITRC guidance document. So we have some questions that have come in. Do the Appendix A tables address depth constraints?
I can take that question. I guess, Leslie, if your question is related to excavation specifically, we do recognize there are limits to excavation, and perhaps there's even at your site issues with geology where you have limitations on drilling depth, for example, some very deep aquifers in the western U.S. So yes, some of those issues are brought up in Appendix A tables.
For mobile LNAPL determination, besides LNAPL presence in wells with no previous LNAPL, do you use additional characterization data such as LIF data to determine mobility?
Well, Joanne, do you want to take that or do you want me to?
No, I was going to just... So I think I'm guessing this question may have come in before part of it. Yes, we did use the LIF data. That's one reason we did two different rounds of LIF, because we did want to determine if it was actually, we were looking for migration. So I guess we weren't using the LIF data maybe the same way to determine mobility, because mobility is a little bit harder to look at. LIF will tell us if the LNAPL is there or not. If it shows up in the well, then we know that it's mobile, but we use the LIF data to actually determine it was migrating because we were seeing it in new locations where it hadn't appeared before.
A participant says soil vapor samples can be highly variable. How can one determine what gradients of methane and CHO2 in natural soil zone depletion are significant? Statistics?
Yeah, that's a good question. The gradient method, I mean, really there's variability in all of the methods. And so I think an important takeaway is when you're measuring NSCD rates and you have a quantitative data objective, there should be an expectation that it's a range of values. And so there's an inherent uncertainty that comes with these measurements, but that said, it can be managed through measurements at different locations, measurements at different times of the year, for example, to help you, again, kind of quantify that range of rates. So yes, a dynamic scenario and one you need to sort of take a look at when you're designing your program.
Another participant says, I still have a problem with air sparging with separate phase product. How do you prevent additional smearing in the soils?
Well
additional...
Go ahead, Lloyd.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the part about additional smearing in the soils, but when you do the air sparging, obviously, when you look at that remedy, LCSM, you got to make sure you're going to be making sure you're not introducing more risk with the migration of vapors and such like that. So you may need SVE on top of that. But on the smearing of the soils, are you talking about moving the L-NAPL around with air sparge? Is that how I understand that question? Or Tom, do you have a different answer?
I guess what I think is basically what you're doing in a sense is soil mixing, in situ soil mixing. So you're using air sparging to mix the L-NAPL into the soil matrix and essentially immobilize it and make it more biodegradable. Of course, with air sparging, I wouldn't necessarily use that, or I'd use it very carefully if I have migrating or highly saturated L-NAPL, but I'd certainly look at air sparging when you have residual L-NAPL. In other words, it may appear in a well, but it's not migrating, it's simply mobile in and out of the well. And in that case, the only way to address the residual L-NAPL and the compositional risks it brings is to move to a phase change technology like air sparging. So I'd like to get people away from the idea that simply doing air sparging is going to be pushing your L-NAPL around. That may happen on a very localized level, but it certainly isn't going to remobilize L-NAPL and make it move down the block, for example.
How much of a factor is biofouling of aquifer matrix and natural source zone depletion for heavier petroleum?
That's a good question. biofouling. So, excuse me. I guess a couple of thoughts to try to answer this question. The NSCD rates that we've been measuring for various different petroleum products, so that whether they be light ends such as condensate or heavier ends such as crude or even weathered diesel for that matter, don't appear to be significantly different. And so I kind of go back to that chart from Bemidji where we're seeing direct oil or direct contact oil biodegradation of the larger carbon compounds. Of even, you know, the larger N-alkyl cyclohexanes. So I don't necessarily think that you should expect to see lower NSCD rates for heavier petroleum compounds. The biofouling thing, I think this is all biodegradation, and so, you know, we've not really run into a scenario where we've seen low NSCD rates because of that factor.
Another question has come in. If groundwater wells are being used to measure L-NAPL reduction, how should wells be treated to ensure a representative measurement? If a well goes months to years between sampling event, does it need to be baled prior to L-NAPL thickness measurement?
Boy, I wish Andrew Kirkman was still on the line. This is Tom Fox. I would say that you definitely want to go ahead and bale the well prior to measuring your L-NAPL, but be aware that we've had this whole discussion about apparent L-NAPL thickness in wells, and I don't know that simply measuring L-NAPL reduction in any one well is going to be useful for you. There are so many variables at play, and I think you mentioned on this as far as seasonality and the depth of water in the well and whether you've got confined, perched, or just water table type situation for your geology, Sarah.
And this is Lloyd. You may want to go re-listen to session two where Andrew Kirkman talked about equilibrium with L-NAPL in the wells and baling before sampling, things like that. But in case you didn't have a chance to listen to session two, that was discussed pretty completely.
And the archive of part two is available now. So if you are interested in that archive, if you go to the CLUIN page where you started today, follow the CLUIN Sun, and from the top you can access training archives. And if you registered for the class, you should also have an email link to the archive as well. I'm sorry, go ahead, Joanne.
Yes, I was going to say another thing that you can consider is to redevelop a well, especially if it has been a long time between sampling periods, but you know, if you're talking like years, if you redevelop it, that would help guarantee that you would be getting a better L-NAPL thickness measurement So that would be something else to consider.
In the case study, was soil vapor ever measured adjacent to the residence and apartment building?
Yes, we did measure soil vapor near the residence and the apartment building. It right next to the, between the tank basin and the apartment building, it was really high. So we did many years of subslab monitoring below the apartment building. And then we also did some indoor sampling, some 24-hour air monitoring in the apartment building in a couple of apartments. And we never did see any elevated risk to the apartment building, and down gradient at the residences. We never saw any additional risk there. We had a lot of trouble trying to do subslab samples because it is so wet at the site and the water table is so high. So we were looking more at 24-hour indoor samples and the soil gas. We were able to do soil gas samples at one point, but the water table was fluctuating so much, it was a really tricky site to get that data. But we never saw any other risks. The risks never increased at the downgradient residences.
Regarding the case study, was the dissolved plume increasing between the El Napo plume identification events?
So for monitoring well one, when we were looking at that slide, it did show that that plume was fairly stable at some point. It was, the levels were fairly high, but it was fairly stable until we started system operation. In monitoring well MW4, some of the concentrations were decreasing, but once LNAPL showed up in that well, then all the concentrations had increased. And we didn't really monitor long enough after it was there. We have about a year of monitoring where it stayed high, and we didn't continue monitoring before we started our system to see if it would have decreased, because since time was now of essence, we had started the system already.
Another question came in. The person asking the question says, I question the use of slurry walls or similar barriers across the El Napo body. The groundwater will flow around the barrier, creates water table gradient affecting El Napo, requiring pumping on the upgradient side of the wall. Is that correct?
Both Lloyd and
this is Lloyd.
Go ahead, Lloyd.
Yeah, that's a good observation. That's why it's so critical when you do a remedy LCSM and a design LCSM is to look at those kind of factors. And if that's going to be a risk, and then that is something you want to know about or consider ahead of time, and maybe the story wall would not be a good for that site. It is not any of the technologies that we talked about today, you have to make sure that you take and look at those technologies and go through the evaluations like Tom and Joanne did to make sure they'd be a good fit.
Yeah, and my response to Don was that, you know, mass control is usually used in concert with another technology group so that you might employ a slurry wall, for example, to either contain or divert the LNAPL so that you can make it more readily recoverable. Or at least to divert the LNAPL around a point of exposure, for example. But obviously, more would need to be done. You can't simply shift the problem from one place to another.
Thank you. We have a participant, Simon List, who's raised his hand. You are welcome to send in a question using that Q&A pod. If you're on the phone line, you can also unmute your phone. It's #6 to unmute to ask questions out loud. We have a question that came in back related to the natural source zone depletion. The person says, I was wondering if that delta T can be translated into a degradation rate in gallons per acre per year.
Yeah, so that is a few analytical steps. So I'll point that questioner to section 4.4 of Appendix B. It's a multiple step process where you measure your delta T. So just to clarify, the delta T is the increased temperature over background. And after you've measured that, you essentially plot it on a depth profile figure. Again, example shown. Multiply it times the thermal conductivity of the soil. That gets you a heat flux value. And then you convert the heat flux value to an NSCD rate by dividing it by a heat of reaction. So there's lots of different terms and crazy heat thermodynamic units in there, but all very clearly explained in section 4.4. That gets you to your gallon acre year number.
Thank you. I will wait another minute or so to see if we have additional questions that have come in. Looking at our poll questions on the bottom left, after attending this three-part training on elm apples, are you ready to select remedial technologies to achieve objectives? And about 75% say yes, another 25% say unsure. And for both groups, we do have our online guidance document that's going to be available as a resource for you. And as we've mentioned here in the question answer, it sounds like there's some great information to answer additional questions that you have. Thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? We have someone who's going to use it to help selecting and remedial technologies. Another person is going to apply the structured approach, and you are welcome to scroll down to see the wide variety of answers that are available here in this question. I'll also give you another reminder on the feedback form. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes at the end of the training to fill out the feedback form. If you would like a certificate, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate the certificate for you, and right now that's the only way to get the certificate. If you have more than one person at your location, after you submit for the first person, there's an opportunity to go back and submit the form again for the other people at your location attending. So if each person wants a certificate, you can do that through the feedback form. We don't have any other questions that have come in, so we'll go ahead and wrap up early for today's class. If we've not completely addressed your question, or if you come up with a question after we wrap up today, please email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with trainers. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. More information is available on the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.